Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcasts, or it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from France 24, NHK Japan, and Radio Havana, Cuba. We will begin with France 24. An interview with Louise Wateridge from the UNWRA, which is the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine. She's a spokesperson who had just returned from 6 weeks on the ground in Gaza. She describes the situation in Rafah before the current attacks, with severe overcrowding and almost no food. In 6 days, most of the Palestinians fled in terror to Al-Mawasi under constant bombardment. UNRWA and the World Food Program tried to provide food, but aid trucks have been blocked at the borders for a week. Louise does not believe that the U.S. pier will be able to reverse the starvation. UNRWA had to close its doors in East Jerusalem following an arson attack by chanting Israeli demonstrators on its grounds. The United Nations and the European Union strongly condemned the attack. Putin is visiting the Chinese president to further the record economic alliances. China denies the American accusation that it supplies arms to Russia. France 24.
Over 1 million people had been sheltering in Rafah, but now some 600,000 of them are thought to have moved again. Now, some have arrived in the Masawi camp. That's where Israel is encouraging Palestinians to head to, despite a lack of food, medicine and shelter. Palestinians there, and indeed across Gaza, say nowhere in the enclave is safe. So I'm very pleased now to welcome to the programme Louise Wateridge. She's a spokesperson for the UN agency for the Palestinians, UNRWA. She herself was in Gaza for 3 weeks. She left just 2 days ago. First of all, let's talk about Rafah, that city in the south of Gaza that Israel has said for a long time it plans to attack. We understand that incursion has now got underway. You were in Rafah. Tell us, first of all, what you witnessed there.
When I arrived in Rafah, the makeshift shelters were almost tent to tent. There was not a lot of space between these shelters. People were crammed in. This is a city that used to have around 250,000 people, and there were around 1.4 million people sheltering there. In the space of about 6 days, Rafah emptied. It was devastating to see how these people fled in absolute fear and terror, especially as the bombardment picked up through the night. There was certainly one night that the bombardment was increased so much. The drones above, you had Navy shelling from the sea and then also incursions coming nearer from the east of Rafah. And that night was really a deciding point for a lot of people. The whole next day, anyone and everyone who could move was moving. And as I left Rafah, these areas that were filled with families just days before, the only thing left was rubbish lying around and packs of dogs going through these rubbish trying to find any scraps of food to eat. So in the space of 7 days, this area just completely transformed and was left very, very eerie.
Yeah, such a bleak picture you paint there of what you witnessed in Rafah. As I mentioned, Israel has been calling on Palestinians there to go to this place called Masawi. It's not a city. It's a pretty small strip of land. Israel says that's the safest place for them to go now. What do you make of that?
There's nowhere safe. There's absolutely nowhere safe. My colleague, Jamal, just a few days ago, he was one of many people and many families who had to flee Rafah for this so-called safety, and he was killed. He was killed in an Israeli strike in Deir al-Balah. This is the reality that people in Gaza are facing. They are being forced to leave multiple times. They are being told there is safety somewhere else. There is not. There is no safety. People are dying. People are being killed. People are starving. People are in absolute fear and terror. It has not stopped. 7 months. Everyone you speak to is exhausted. They are wearing this exhaustion on their face. They are so tired of this life that they are living. It's not a life. It is a survival. And it is not acceptable that people are experiencing this and surviving through this suffering.
We've been reporting that the border with Rafah has been shut. And obviously, there have been significant restrictions by Israel on your own agency, on UNRWA.
UNRWA continues to do everything possible. We're working very closely with partners like WFP, the World Food Programme, to do anything and everything we can to safely distribute food to people. This is in the north of the Gaza Strip and the south. But as you say, and as the world is very aware, with the crossings in the south of the Gaza Strip not functioning, this makes it incredibly difficult. This also comes on the back of seven whole months of unsustained aid delivery. It's not the case that the crossing is closed now for a week and that's an issue. It's never been enough aid. There has never been enough food. So yes, now when you have the crossing closed 1 day, 2 days, 2 weeks, it is a huge problem. Of course, it's a huge problem. People have not eaten. They've not had enough sustained food for the duration of this war. Right now, not only people fleeing for their lives again in terms of forced displacement, they are also very aware that this border crossing is closed, food is limited, and that creates even more panic, more fear for people. If we are to get any limited aid in, it's not enough. It's nowhere near enough. The humanitarian agencies are doing everything they can, but there's very limited fuel as well. They're working on an hour-by-hour basis. How is it possible to sustain critical food and life-saving water and supplies and medicine to an entire 2 million population when you can't even plan the next day of your operations? It's just unbelievable. Before the war, there were around 500 trucks a day. This was humanitarian and commercial supplies. We have not seen anything close to that. Nothing close to that. And now we are in the complete middle of a war. It is not acceptable that there is not enough aid coming in. You have UNRWA on the ground. You have World Food Programme. They are working together. The United Nations are there. There is a huge humanitarian presence of staff ready to provide aid where it's needed. But we do not have the access. How can people do their jobs if they don't have the access and they don't have the aid coming in? It's that simple. Open the crossings. Let the aid in. Let the humanitarians do their jobs. And this will not continue. People will not starve.
The United States says that they have now completed the pier that they want to build just off the Gaza Strip in the waters off Gaza to bring food and supplies in that way. What do you make of that?
The easiest way to bring in any aid to the Gaza Strip is through the land crossings, through trucks, through the people on the ground, and through the systems and mechanisms that we have in place. It's that simple. That is the way that aid needs to be delivered to people. It goes straight from the crossings to the people in the shelters, to the people to be distributed. It's the simplest, it's the easiest way, and that is where the pressure needs to be.
Louise Waterridge talking to us from UNRWA. It's been really interesting to get your perspective. Thank you very much indeed for talking to us today.
The main UN agency for aid to Palestinians has closed its doors in East Jerusalem following an arson attack on its grounds. UNRWA says chanting Israeli demonstrators set fire to the compound on Thursday evening, its flames engulfing about 70 meters of dry bush.
Some locals started that fire. We have them on CCTV. We then had a second fire 2 hours later, very near our petrol station in the back of the compound. petrol and diesel. And of course, this would have been very dangerous if that had exploded the whole community, because we have many residents here, many neighbors.
Since the start of the war on Gaza last October, Israeli officials have repeatedly called for the agency to be shut down. UNRWA has long been a target of Israeli hostility. Thursday's attack, following months of extremists staging protests outside the compound, at times turning violent. The targeting of the agency was condemned by the UN Secretary General and European officials.
The EU strongly condemns the attack against the UNRWA premises in East Jerusalem. Perpetrators must be held to account. It is Israel's responsibility to ensure the safety of humanitarian workers. UNRWA is an irreplaceable lifeline to millions in Gaza and the region.
UNRWA employs around 13,000 people and coordinates nearly all aid to Gaza. But the agency has been in crisis since January, when Israel accused about a dozen of its employees of being involved in the October attack. The accusation led to many donor nations, including the United States, to suspend funding to the agency, hampering its efforts to deliver aid to the enclave.
It's the Russian president's second visit to China in 7 months, and according to Vladimir Putin, the relationship is as strong as ever.
For the past 5 years, despite the aftermath of the pandemic and some actions from the third-party countries directed at containing our development, the trade between Russia and China is growing at a good pace.
President Xi Jinping nodded as Putin celebrated their portfolio of 80 large joint investment projects and announced that the shares of bilateral trade conducted in rubles and yuan has topped 90%. In February 2022, the pair declared their alliance as a no-limits partnership, right before Russia's invasion of Ukraine the same month, that triggered slews of Western sanctions on Moscow. But despite the penalties, the Russian economy was not brought to its knees, instead experiencing 3.6% growth last year, helped by closer trade ties with its neighbour. According to Chinese data, bilateral trade hit a record $240 billion last year, up 64% since 2021, with Beijing becoming Moscow's key supplier of clothing, cars and raw materials, amongst other things. China, for its part, imported 107 million tonnes of Russian crude oil last year, 24% more than it did the year prior. Whilst Beijing defends trade with its neighbour, saying it doesn't supply arms for Moscow's war effort, it does export over $300 million worth of dual-use items, such as components that could be used to create weapons, every month. However, its exports dipped significantly in March and April after the US threatened to go after financial institutions that aid Russia's war efforts.
That interview and those reports were from France 24. France 24 may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English. They are also available at most podcast sites, as is the shortwave report. Next, NHK World Radio Japan. Residents of Okinawa continue to demand a large pullout by the U.S. military and the end of the deployment of missiles in their area. Hiroshima held its annual reading of the names of the 339,227 people who died from the U.S. bombing in 1945. Atomic bomb survivors launched a protest with the U.S. over recent comments by Senator Lindsey Graham, who likened the Israeli-Gaza conflict to the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki on steroids, saying it was the right decision. Japan's electrical demand is about to soar because of generative artificial intelligence server farms. The navies of the United States and Taiwan conducted another covert military drill, increasing tension with China. Netanyahu says the Rafah ground offensive will last weeks, not months, as the U.S. prepares to send another billion-dollar round of weapons to Israel. NHK Japan.
Residents of Okinawa continue to demand a bigger U.S. pullout more than half a century after the prefecture's return to Japanese rule. People, including members of residents groups and labor unions, held what they called a peace march on Ishigaki Island. Wednesday marked 52 years since the prefecture's reversion to Japan from post-war U.S. rule. The demonstrators also voiced opposition to the deployment of a missile unit in the area. Japan's government opened a ground self-defense force base on the island in March last year to strengthen the defense of the country's southwestern islands. At the time of Okinawa's return, residents hoped the presence of U.S. military facilities would be reduced to at least the same level as in other parts of the country. But the prefecture hosts about 70% of all the facilities in Japan. Officials in Hiroshima City are taking a solemn ritual into the digital age. Every year, they air out a registry listing those who have died as a result of the atomic bomb. And they've live-streamed the event for the first time. About 20 workers gathered Wednesday at Peace Memorial Park. They first offered a silent prayer at 8:15 a.m., the exact time the bomb was dropped in 1945. They next took out the registry, comprising 126 books. They're stored in a cenotaph and need airing out to prevent any damage from the humidity. The list currently includes the names of 339,227 people who had died as of August 5th last year.
I hope people remember the victims and widely share their wishes for lasting world peace.
Uemoto says he hopes the ritual is viewed by younger generations. Atomic bomb survivors have lodged a protest with the United States over recent comments by a senator. Lindsey Graham likened the Israel-Hamas conflict to Hiroshima and Nagasaki on steroids. The Republican was speaking on May 8th, and in an interview with U.S. media on Sunday, he said bombing the two Japanese cities was the right decision. Now, the Japan Confederation of A and H-bomb sufferers organizations wants Graham's remarks retracted. Officials with the group wrote a letter to the U.S. Embassy in Tokyo saying the senator's words go against international humanitarian law. They also say nuclear weapons must never be used again and should not have been allowed to exist in the first place. On Tuesday, Foreign Minister Kamikawa Yoko described Graham's remarks as extremely regrettable. She also vowed to accurately convey the devastating reality of nuclear weapons. Japan's electricity demand has been dropping for over a decade because of energy-saving efforts and a shrinking population. But that trend is likely to reverse this year due to the rapid spread of generative AI, which uses large amounts of electricity. Officials have begun discussions on an energy plan to meet the expected demand. AI and cloud services require major data centers like this one near Tokyo.
One server alone consumes the same amount of power as three households combined.
This center alone will consume as much as 30,000 households, and more of them are springing up across the nation. The navies of the U.S. and Taiwan reportedly conducted drills in the Western Pacific last month. It's the latest step as the two sides look to strengthen cooperation amid China's growing military presence in the region. Reuters news agency reported on Tuesday about the unpublicized drills. One source said the exercises involved about half a dozen naval ships. The source said the drills were focused on basic operations such as communications, refueling, and resupply. Taiwan's Defense Ministry spokesperson confirmed exercises had taken place.
The Taiwanese Navy carried out routine exercises in line with the code for unplanned encounters at sea.
But he did not provide any details about the drills. China's Foreign Ministry spokesperson reacted sharply to the report.
Taiwan's attempts to seek independence or refuse unification by force will lead to destruction and end in failure.
He called on the United States and Taiwan to end their military collusion.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the Rafah ground offensive will last weeks, not months. This comes as the U.S. prepares to send another round of weapons to Israel. The United States seems to be changing its tone. U.S. President Joe Biden had previously threatened to cut off weapons to Israel if it went ahead with a ground offensive in Rafah. But multiple U.S. media outlets now say Washington plans to sell more than $1 billion worth of weapons to Tel Aviv. The package reportedly includes tank ammunition and combat vehicles. Local media suggest Biden is trying not to cause a rift with Israel.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan on shortwave. They are now heard at 10 p.m. at 11735 or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp, as well as most podcast sites. All the times they announce are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could help support this listener-funded program, like listeners in Athens, Georgia and Willits, California did this week, you could write to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California 95490. My online support information is available at outfarpress.com. Many, many thanks to everyone who has ever helped to keep this freely distributed show airborne. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. Dozens of areas in Mexico experienced record high temperatures last week, up to 124 degrees Fahrenheit. Brazil has been hit with extreme rainfall and tragic flooding. At least 500 medical personnel have been killed in Gaza, along with 35,000 Gazans, mostly women and children. Pro-Palestinian demonstrations continue across colleges around the world. Radio Havana, Cuba.
Mexican health authorities reported deaths of at least 10 people related to the heat wave that has pushed temperatures above 50 degrees Celsius in the center of the country. The health services of the city of San Luis Potosí reported that more than 40 people have needed to be hospitalized for symptoms related to heat stroke and sudden dehydration, in addition to confirming 4 deaths due to this condition and registering 6 more under SADI. Imuri Vaca Avila, general director of this institution, confirmed that they are facing a critical situation. An intense heat wave is hitting our state, and it is especially in the hot-spot area, where temperatures have reached astonishing levels of up to more than 50 degrees, she said. The official warned of a worrying increase in people arriving at hospitals as a result of a heat stroke, which can be extremely dangerous. These are the first confirmed deaths in the second heat wave in the year in Mexico, where a dozen cities broke their temperature records between last Thursday and Friday.
Brazilian authorities reported this Monday that due to the rains that hit the south of the country, there are already 148 dead, 127 missing, and 806 injured. In the most affected region, Rio Grande do Sul, at least 147 deaths were reported, and in the state of Santa Catarina, 1 death. According to the latest civil defense bulletin, rains and floods have spread in Rio Grande do Sul, affecting 447 of the 497 municipalities and some 2.12 million inhabitants. The authorities have had to house 80,826 people in schools, gyms, and churches, whilst 538,241 are in the homes of family and friends. The Palestinian Health Ministry in the Gaza Strip says the ongoing Israeli onslaught has claimed the lives of hundreds of doctors and medical staff, this across the besieged territory. In a statement released on Sunday, the ministry said the regime's forces have killed at least 500 medical personnel across Gaza since the genocide started on October past. It added that the figure includes at least 138 nurses who have lost their lives as a result of the regime's indiscriminate strikes. The ministry called on the international community to take necessary measures to, quote, protect medical personnel and health institutions in Gaza. Throughout their genocidal war, the Israeli occupational forces have made Gaza's hospitals regular targets of relentless strikes, killing not only the medical staff, but also patients and displaced Palestinians taking shelter in medical complexes. On May the 2nd, the World Health Organization said it had documented 443 Israeli attacks on Gaza's healthcare sector since the regime's genocidal war started. According to the world body, the regime's attacks, quote, have resulted in 723 fatalities, 924 injuries, damage to 101 facilities, and affected 106 ambulances. Since the beginning of Israel's genocidal war, the regime has killed at least 35,034 civilians, most of them women and children, leaving 78,755 Palestinians injured. The death toll, as well as the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Gaza, has many progressive and anti-war activists in the United States critical of their country's role in the war. The U.S. has long been Israel's closest ally, supplying the country with about $3.8 billion each year in military aid. Critics have blasted that support, as well as the billions of dollars in additional assistance used to bolster the war since it started in October. On U.S. college campuses, though, the pushback is especially fierce as students question their university's relationships with weapons manufacturers and other companies with ties to Israel's military. Quote, these are supposedly social justice-oriented institutions, but their actions say entirely differently, said Siki Chapman, a freshman at Pomona College, a liberal arts institution in Claremont, California. Chapman was amongst the student protesters arrested last month for setting up a pro-Palestinian encampment on school grounds. The demonstration is part of an effort to force the college to sever its ties with Israel and any companies that support its military campaign in Gaza. Quote, eventually we will look back on this and see that we were on the right side of history, Chapman said. For decades, institutions of higher education in the United States have collaborated with the country's defense and aerospace sectors, the largest such industries in the world. Concerns about the implications have lingered for decades, too. In 1961, for instance, former President Dwight Eisenhower warned of the dangers of the military-industrial complex entering the academic sphere.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu. However, there's no podcast. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140 and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Daylight Saving Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You have to look harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online support. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The shortwave report, which is now in its 28th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report has been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. While I am recuperating from spinal injury, I'm staying in a house that is connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.